It is considered a weapon of mass destruction due to the fact that if you come into contact with it, it can kill you pretty efficiently.
Malaysia says Kim Jong-un's half-brother attacked with deadly nerve poison. It's Monday, February 27th. This is VOA Asia. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We invite you to log on right now to our Facebook page, VOA Asia, for a greater program experience. Also ahead, Indonesia and Australia calm tensions. China quietly making deals in South Asia. Depression a prevalent issue in Asia. And your water may come from snow. It flows your way right now on VOA Asia. Malaysian health authorities say Kim Jong-nam suffered a very painful death and was dead within 20 minutes of being attacked at the Kuala Lumpur International Airport. Local police say the older half-brother of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un was killed February 13th by VX nerve agent. Surveillance video shows two women shoving something into Kim's face. Police have both females in custody, as well as a North Korean man suspected of being behind the attack. Seven other North Koreans have also been identified as suspects and are wanted for questioning. Experts say VX is one of the deadliest chemical weapons created by man. Just 10 milligrams of the nerve agent, or a single drop, is enough to kill in minutes. On Sunday, officials said the Kuala Lumpur International Airport was free of toxic substances following a terminal-wide sweep. Michael Madden of the U.S.-Korea Institute at SAIS and contributor to the 38 North website tells VOA Sarah Williams about VX and its use in this attack.
It is considered a weapon of mass destruction, and I think they've cleaned the airport at this point, but it is considered a weapon of mass destruction due to the fact that if you come into contact with it, it can kill you pretty efficiently, and it can be used. I mean, VX can also be used and in weaponized into things like artillery shells and in missiles.
This type of killing, an investigation is continuing, but apparently, I guess you could say, people in the North Korean government probably wanted Mr. Kim out of the picture. The fact that this was used, however, what does it indicate about the people responsible for this?
There have been fairly credible reports that they had tried to assassinate Kim Jong-nam, and this was long before Kim Jong-un was on the political scene in North Korea. There was a rumored assassination attempt in 2004 and another one in 2011, which Kim Jong-nam later commented about to a South Korean journalist. So I think in the previous instances where they tried to assassinate him, they might have tried to use a poison. They might have tried to shoot him. But in this particular case, VX and using VX, it basically suggests that Kim Jong-nam was not going to leave Kuala Lumpur alive. This would be done in such a way that if he were to go and complain about a medical problem, it would sound like he was having a heart attack or had food poisoning or something like that. And so they basically were ensuring that he was going to die or he was just not going to survive in any way from this. And that's the reason why they would have used VX. They were going to ensure that he was going to die from this and not be taken to a hospital and be able to recover and start talking about, you know, who was targeting him and all sorts of other things like that.
It is alleged that these two women were the ones who perpetrated this, but the fact that there were two of them, and apparently I think each used a different type of chemical, I mean, they could have potentially been hurt as well.
Yes, I mean, there's been a report that one of the ladies was sick after the fact. The other one, the main perpetrator of this, she must have washed her hands immediately. One prophylactic step one takes from VX is that as long as you wash your hands immediately and make your hands come in contact with respiratory passages, then there may not be an issue. I believe also that the main lady, this is the woman that was seen wearing the LOL shirt, but also used a rag or some type of cloth and swabbed Kim Jong-nam's face with it. So again, this is just sort of a little added layer of protection. But I mean, as long as she had washed her hands immediately after and sort of, you know, held her hands in front of her face and just went to a bathroom and washed her hands, then she would have been fine.
Well, and those responsible for this had no doubt been monitoring Kim Jong-nam's whereabouts, because I guess he was mainly in Macau, but he was visiting Malaysia.
Kim Jong-nam moved around pretty well. I mean, he had a house in Beijing, he had a house in Macau, he had a house in Shanghai. He had access to a Kim family residence in Singapore, and he had a place to stay in Malaysia. So, I mean, he moved around. The most credible report that I have heard is that there was somebody following or keeping Kim Jong-nam under surveillance for about a year before this happened. He had felt, I think, that he had been followed by somebody in Macau. And so I think that that's where they started the attack or gathering information about him.
U.S. Korea Institute expert Michael Madden, we invite you to read more by following our Facebook page, VOA Asia, and the VOAnews.com website. These are among the top Asia stories trending on VOAnews.com. China likely to keep spending more on its navy. Reports say dozens die in violence across Afghanistan. Officials say Pakistani religious schools increasingly linked to Afghan Taliban. Airport safe, Malaysia says, following nerve agent attack. Taliban leaders want Afghans to plant more trees. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and much more on Facebook at VOA Asia and on our VOAnews.com website. VOA Asia continues. Indonesian President Joko Widodo has made his first visit to Australia in a sign that tensions early this year have eased and relations between the two Asia-Pacific neighbors are stable. Australia and Indonesia said Sunday that full military ties between the two countries had been restored after Indonesia's military suspended cooperation in January because of, quote, insulting teaching materials found at an Australian base that suggested that Indonesia's Papua province should be independent and mock the nation-state ideology. Standing alongside Indonesian President Widodo, Australian Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull announced greater trade between the two nations.
The potential for us to expand our economic relationship is very clear, and we are both committed to concluding a high-quality bilateral free trade agreement, the Indonesia-Australia Comprehensive Economic Partnership, by the end of this year. And this will facilitate more opportunities for Australian and Indonesian businesses and create more jobs in both Australia and Indonesia.
Phil Mercer reports from Sydney that trade, security, and tensions in the South China Sea were among the key topics discussed during Widodo's two-day visit.
Australia's relationship with its heavily populated northern neighbour is often turbulent. It soured when Australia supported East Timorese independence from Indonesia in 2002. More recently, in 2015, diplomatic tension rose when Jakarta executed two members of an Australian drug trafficking gang, despite pleas for mercy from Canberra. In January, Indonesia briefly suspended bilateral military ties after a dispute at an Australian Special Forces base in Perth. Those anxieties have soothed, and there's optimism that President Joko Widodo's visit will see meaningful progress on a free trade agreement. Aaron Connolly, an analyst at the Lowy Institute, a Sydney-based think tank, says ties between the two countries are in good shape.
The remarkable thing here is that despite that background of irritation that we see on occasion, relations between the two are actually pretty good. Ministers on both sides have good relationships with their counterparts. And you also have Australian feelings toward Indonesia at a high. In our Lowy Institute poll last year, we asked Australians to rank countries on a thermometer from 0 to 100. And Indonesia ranked at 56 degrees, which is the highest result we've ever seen in 11 years of polling.
President Widodo and Australian Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull discussed the dangers posed by radicalized fighters returning home from the conflict in Iraq and Syria. Tensions over the South China Sea are an additional topic, along with the possibility of joint Navy patrols in the area. While significant, the Indonesian leader was forced to cancel an earlier state trip to Australia last November because of violent disturbances in Jakarta. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
This is VOA Asia. Happening now in Asia, one of the fiercest critics of Philippines President Rodrigo Duterte, Senator Leyla de Lima, has been arrested on drug charges. She's accused of having abetted the illegal drug trade in New Bilibid Prison when she was Justice Secretary from 2010 to 2015. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad you could join us today for VOA Asia. Countries in Southeast Asia are talking one-on-one with China about shared rights to fish and fossil fuels in the contested South China Sea, but nationalism or lack of political trust may snarl any agreements and shift focus to informal economic deals. Senior leaders from China and Vietnam met last month to talk about maritime cooperation that could include a joint search for undersea oil or gas. It was China's latest effort to talk privately with a maritime rival since July, when a World Arbitration Tribunal in The Hague ruled the basis for Beijing's claims to about 95% of the sea lack legal merit. Experts like Andrew Yang, Secretary General of the Chinese Council on Advanced Policy Studies at the think tank in Taiwan, forecast eventual deals on fishing rights or fishery management. China, Vietnam, and the Philippines are especially keen on fishing rights with their vessels spanning much of the sea.
First thing that they want to do is to identify the fishing rights, and I think that's important because you have to come up with some kind of discipline or some kind of practice in terms of the division of labor or the areas of fishing activities.
In a sign how a fishery deal might work, since 2006, Vietnam and China have jointly patrolled fisheries in the shared Gulf of Tonkin. Last year, the two sides extended the patrol route. Douglas Guilfoyle, Associate International Law Professor at Monash University in Australia, says resource-sharing deals work legally if signatories lay aside the sovereignty questions, but populations at home may still suspect their governments are giving in.
They're harder to pull off in practice than in theory. There are practical negotiating issues, but then the other issues of politics, trust, and whether your own citizens will ultimately support such a thing.
Alexander Huang, strategic studies professor at Tom Kong University in Taiwan, says as Southeast Asian maritime claimants are eager to grow their own economies, Beijing may ask nations to stay quiet about China's land reclamation at sea, increased military presence on some of the islets, or Coast Guard journeys through waters frequented by other parties.
They are investing heavily in providing aid and support and infrastructure that trying to show, on one hand, China's strength in doing so, or the second, to dissuade other countries from disputing China over the South China Sea.
Separately, China is to pursue a code of conduct framework this year with the 10-member Association of Southeast Asian Nations after years of resisting it. You're listening to VOA Asia.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
This news alert from VOA Asia. Average life expectancy will increase globally by 2030, both at birth and at the age of 65, according to a new study. South Korea is projected to lead the way with a life expectancy of 90.8 years. Improvements in maternal and child health and improved adult health are lengthening lives. All the big stories come your way throughout the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. VOA Asia continues as the World Health Organization reports depression is increasing worldwide and is now the leading cause of global disability. About half of the global number of people who suffer from depression live in Asia. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva, where the UN agency has just released a new global health estimate on depression.
The World Health Organization reports more than 300 million people, or more than 4% of the global population, were living with depression in 2015. The numbers mark an 18% increase over a 10-year period. Dan Chisholm is Health Systems Advisor in the WHO's Department of Mental Health and Substance Abuse and a lead author of the report. He says depression is a disorder that can affect anyone at any point in that person's life.
If you look at the prevalence of different disorders around the world and you look at the disability that is associated with them, if you combine those together, depression ends up at the top of the list because it's A, very common, you can see, 1 in 20 people in the world have it, and then it has quite a high level of impairment or disability associated with it.
The report finds prevalence rates for depression peak among older adults, affecting 2% more women between the ages of 55 and 74 than men. Across all age groups, however, the report notes depression is 1.5 times more common among females than males. Breaking a widespread misconception, Chisholm says the disorders are not diseases of the rich or the affluent. He says more than 80% of these conditions are present in low- and middle-income countries. He tells VOA depression is rising mainly because the world's population is growing and aging, particularly in developing countries.
For example, African countries might have 40-50% of the population under the age of 15. But as they transition, they might have only 30%. So you have more people reaching adulthood where the rates of depression are higher.
While depression is a growing problem in Africa, the report notes nearly half of all people living with the disorder are in the heavily populated regions of Southeast Asia and the Western Pacific. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Developing at this hour in Asia, Pakistan's military has announced a major new nationwide operation to deal with militancy in the country in the wake of a string of terrorist attacks. The announcement comes after a wave of bloody attacks has led to mounting police criticism of the army and the government. VOA Asia keeps you informed all day on Facebook at VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, there's a good chance that you or someone you know gets their water from snow. That's because as snow melts in high elevations or colder regions, it flows into streams and rivers that eventually reach human populations. The U.S. space agency NASA studies weather patterns from space, but the dazzling reflective nature of snow makes it hard to measure it from space. NASA weather scientists report current worldwide estimates of water stored in snow may be off by as much as 30-50%. And so NASA is launching an ambitious project to create a new snow satellite. The first steps actually are not in satellites, but in airplanes and on snowy mountains, as Shelley Schlender reports from Peterson Air Force Base in Colorado.
In dry northern regions such as Colorado, the melting from winter snowpack is crucial for filling reservoirs, growing crops, and providing drinking water. Communities in the region get 80% of their water from snowpack, so knowing the water content of snow helps them plan ahead. At the always busy and very noisy Peterson Air Force Base in Colorado Springs, U.S. Forest Service scientist Frank McCormick explains that the standard method of measuring snowpack involves tromping through snow to specially chosen sites, then doing some serious digging.
They'll dig a snow pit down to bare ground so that they can take very detailed measurements, everything from temperature to water that's in the snow.
Scientists must sometimes dig snow pits over 5 meters deep. Then, careful measurements can accurately reveal the location's snowpack levels and water content. But on a global scale, McCormick says digging snow pits isn't practical.
We would need thousands upon thousands upon thousands of sites throughout the world.
That's why NASA has launched SnowX. It's a 5-year project to design a snow satellite that will accurately measure snowpack from space. This means the satellite might be able to measure snowpack everywhere. Snowpack project leader Edward Kim says knowing snowpack's water content, when it's likely to melt and so on, could help over 1 billion people.
1 out of every 6 people in the world depends the majority of their water that they use for drinking and agriculture and industry comes from snow.
To design the satellite, 100 SnowX scientists are teaming up to figure out the best ways to remotely measure snowpack's depth, its water content, how surface dust and temperature affect snow, and more. As a first step, Kim says they're putting snow sensors above the Earth, though not as high as a satellite. He points over his shoulder at a big propeller plane. The plane has a special bumpy nose and a pointy tail. Kim says this is a plane equipped for measuring snow.
The airplanes carry the sensors of the same type that would eventually be on a satellite.
Inside the plane, half a dozen scientists are fine-tuning 10 kinds of weather sensors, including microwave and laser. The scientists stay on board as pilots fly over pre-selected snowy mountains in Colorado and high snowy mesas. They're looking for instruments that can accurately measure snow levels on craggy peaks, in deep valleys, and even see past trees and forests. At its heart, the goal is simple.
There are so many people dependent on snow. And given this changing climate, who knows what happens? So if we can get a very good handle how to predict, the changing snow in a changing climate, I think it's going to benefit a lot of people.
NASA's SNOWEX team plans to use the data from this five-year project to make better predictions about snowpack around the world, including someday through a snow satellite. And they plan to share their data to help people wherever there is snow. For VOA News, I'm Shelley Schlender at the Peterson Air Force Base in Colorado.
Whether it's snowy or quite warm where you're listening, we thank you for joining us on VOA Asia and to all of our friends in Myanmar who have listened through VOA Burmese Facebook. Thank you so much. We know there are many of you listening each and every day. We're glad to have you with us. You can also find us streaming on our website at voanews.com, and we have our own Facebook page at VOA Asia, which provides our show each and every day. We're also a podcast. You can download it, take it with you wherever you go. Our special thanks to director Tracy Carter and our engineer Keith Holmes, managing editor Diane Gao, and our entire VOA Asia team. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We hope you have a great day. Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is continuing to provide food assistance to its partner, Malawi. U.S. Ambassador to Malawi, Virginia Palmer, recently announced a new U.S. donation of $4.6 million to assist Malawian people in need of humanitarian food assistance. This additional donation is in response to the Malawi Vulnerability Assessment Committee's report that 6.7 million Malawians need imminent food assistance to alleviate suffering. Funds will be channeled through the UN World Food Program. Ambassador Palmer said she appreciated President Peter Mutharika's leadership in dealing with the worst food crisis of the Southern Africa drought. She also praised Vice President Saulos Chilima's months-long work to bring all stakeholders to the table to address Malawi's food crisis. Of the $4.6 million, $2.5 million will be used to transport and distribute 10,800 metric tons of maize from the Malawian government's Strategic Grain Reserve, and $2.1 million is education funding, repurposed to fill a critical gap in Malawi's school feeding program. This additional assistance brings the United States government's total contribution to the 2016-2017 Food Insecurity Response Plan to $126 million, equivalent to about one-third of the plan's $395 million estimated cost. Ambassador Palmer pledged that the United States will continue to work with the government of Malawi to break the cycle of food insecurity. Key to this is Malawi's fulfilling its new Alliance for Food Security and Nutrition commitments. These include a review of the Control of Goods Act, which has inhibited investment in food production, and passage of a seed bill consistent with Malawi's commitment to SADC seed harmonization so Malawi's farmers can access and sell quality seeds across the region. Reforms are urgently required to help avoid future food shortages caused not only by climate change, but by the unpredictability of Malawi's maize markets. The United States government continues to stand by Malawians in their time of need, said Ambassador Palmer. But together we recognize that policy and market predictability are critical if Malawi's farmers are to become entrepreneurs, if agribusinesses are to invest, and if Malawi is to transform its agriculture sector from a source of vulnerability into an engine for growth.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.